Colonel Fatherby, Reel 6. We're talking about Major David Lowe and his influence, because he was a second in command for the first 2 years of Foreman Hardy's colonelcy. What did you think of David Lowe?
Well, he was a company secretary of boots. He was a solicitor by training, and he was a thoroughly reliable and sensible person. Good gunner experience, and I'm sure he kept a close eye on Tom Foreman Hardy. It was interesting, of course, that he got half the players element and the boots element coming together in bringing into the running of the South Knots business experience.
So Gunn and Lowe were both of a similar type in the business orientated type.
Right. Yeah.
Anything else happening in the early period of Tom Foreman's colonelcy? Any particular issues you remember? There seem to have been some early restrictions on the TA in 1959.
I can't remember what they were.
That's okay. Well, one thing we've had, the Jubilee parades in London and Nottingham, they seem to have been quite big. Do you remember them? They were 58, actually, but just dropped them in.
I'm sure we must have fired a salute somewhere.
But not something you particularly remember.
No.
The next thing, really, is the... There seems to have been a big switch in 1960 where they seem to have moved into a civil defence training role.
Yes.
Now, this isn't very clear to me. They continued to be artillery, but they had this was an additional role,
that's
was it?
Right.
And they actually went to a camp at Milson?
Milham.
And
that was a civil defence training centre at Milham, where territorial regiments were trained in rescue, principally in case of atomic warfare dropping on the UK, when I think artillery would be useless, but they wanted to train people to carry out rescue. And we went to Milham for a fortnight training in derelict houses and that kind of thing. I was absent from the first week, and then I went up the second week. I remember that was one of the few camps I only went for a week.
What exactly were they doing?
They were hiding bodies in burning buildings and smoke and all this, and you know, respirators on, and they were dragging the bodies out and carrying out first aid training to them, and generally speaking, rescue work was the cry. And the lads enjoyed it for a change. It went down quite well.
Did they see? I mean, you'd miss your gunnery training, that summer camp training, then, that year.
Missed that summer camp training, yes.
Was that prejudicial to your gunner role?
Yes.
Was it worrying people?
I mean, if you were, yes, I mean, it would worried all of us in the sense that you've got so little time to actually fire the gun. When you think that we did do some weekend firing camps, but not many in those days, very few. So we were firing on the odd weekend at either Otterburn or Lark Hill. During that period, but it was not like taking the whole regiment to camp with all its equipment and vehicles and doing fire movement over a large range area. You couldn't do it in the time. And if we went to Otterburn or we went to Lark Hill, we set out on Friday night at 6 o'clock, as they still do, and it takes them until about 1 o'clock in the morning or later to get there. They're up again at 9 o'clock in the morning firing on the range, and then they finish on the Sunday morning and come home, and they come home at 6 o'clock. I mean, they're absolutely worn out. Only just virtually dropping the vehicles and the guns off in the drill hall, and then somebody else has to kind of maintain the kit. So it isn't easy to do a weekend because of the problem that we have, that we can only fire in certain places in the UK.
Now, there were other things happening in the 60s. There seems to be a wives' club formed. Is this part of the effort to retain personnel by involving the family?
Yes.
Is that what it was going on?
No, I don't know quite who actually formed the wives' club, but it sounds to me a bit like a James Gunn venture. Did in fact go on for some years. It was paralleled by the wives' club they had during the war, when there was a strong wives' club which got together to, you know, keep the wives happy and also to ensure that the men in the desert got some goodies.
Now, there was a stand down in 60 as well, from July to September. Was there always a stand down, or is this a special, you know, they just stood down, and then the reorganisation took place with the formation of the HQ battery?
No, I think that was just a normal stand down period, which we normally had after. I mean, we don't normally train in August because everybody's on holiday and that kind of thing. A lot of work holidays are in that period of time, so we felt that it wasn't worth, you know, doing a serious training during that period.
What about your relationships with the higher organisations you were in? You know, the division. This is throughout the 50s and you know, the various the division. Which division were you attached to?
In 1965, we were in 49 Infantry Division, TA.
What was your relation? I think you were in those earlier as well. What was your relationship with 49th Division? It's a territorial division. I mean, how did you link up with them?
Well, the divisional commander obviously had the responsibility to ensure that 307 Battery was an efficient organisation. So the CO would probably have fairly close liaison with the divisional commander. I don't think that the average man on the average soldier really realised what the position was. The main problem was that the problem really was, and this got worse and worse as the years went on. Although artillery is supposed to support infantry and armoured vehicles and armoured formations, it was virtually impossible to actually get tanks and infantry and gunners firing on the same piece of territory. And therefore, we did not do much all-arms training. In fact, very little all-arms training. That particular brochure was from the artillery weekend on the 3rd and 4th of April 1965, which was not a firing weekend, but was just an all-gunner weekend to explain what other gunner regiments did.
What about, they seem to have inspected you, the general officer commander, there's reference to Birbeck coming, Major General Birbeck, and there's talk about annual admin inspections that were done by various senior officers of the division. What were the inspections like? How important were they, and
well,
how rigorous?
They were important in the sense that the report, if it was a bad report, reflected upon the CO and the regiment generally. And I think one was always conscious of the fact that if you kept on getting a bad report, if anybody was going to be taken out of the order of battle, it was probably one of the worst reports. So it was important that you got as good a report as you could possibly get.
And that was an annual report.
And it also reflected upon those regular officers who were with you from as adjutants and quartermasters. Because it reflected upon their personal careers if they got bad notices.
So it was a big effort to get everything very tidied up, smart and clean.
Yes.
How rigorous were the inspections?
I would say they were rigorous. Yes. They often took place during the week when the territorial soldiers weren't there. I mean, for instance, they would bring a team and inspect all the vehicles, and you'd probably get the vehicles over the weekend.
So they'd warn you?
Oh, yes, they would certainly warn you.
Because it would have been a more efficient method of inspecting if they'd just landed on you.
Yes. Bear in mind, in fact, however, that at any time on a firing camp or even a weekend, there was the ability of senior management, if you like, to come along and actually see you do it on the ground. And also, you always had, when you were firing, regular instructors in gunnery who would report on whether or not the gunnery was efficient or not. So there was quite a considerable feedback into the system.
So although they'd come and they'd warn you when they're coming to inspect the vehicles and the back and Bulwell or whatever,
yes.
they were with you frequently at the camps, not necessarily yes. the general officer, but his staff officers or
right.
senior members of his staff. So it wasn't just a matter of being efficient one day a year for them.
No. I mean, the worst thing a gunner can do is to fire his gun and it goes outside his range area. I mean, it happened on the odd occasion. I mean, we did fire one round into West Lavington, which is outside the range area at Larkhill, but that does show up on the reports when that kind of thing happens. But generally speaking, our reports were satisfactory.
The other thing, perhaps, about, we've had a fair number of camps now. We've talked about how the camps were marked by a fair amount of drinking amongst the officers and possibly the men to a lesser extent. What about the sort of pranks and practical jokes that you got up to? You've mentioned in passing some of these, but there seems to have been several, you know, long-running things that were established in the 50s and stealing of various statues and things. If you could tell us about them, because we haven't really heard much about that yet. What sort of japes did they get up to in either the officers' mess or the sergeants or in other ranks?
Well, the other ranks were restricted in the sense that they didn't have their own canteen. They used the NAFI, and the NAFI kept a fairly close control over what they did. If the lads were going to get up to any tricks of the trade, they were certainly going to go down to the local pub and carry on. Sergeants had their own mess, but sergeants, I always find, are fairly straight-laced and don't really get up to anything strange and unorthodox. The officers' mess was the one that really led the party. Oh, we've done silly things. As you quite rightly say, we used to have a statue that appeared.
Tell me about that, because although we've heard from one person, tell us what they would do with this. Where was this? And what?
Well, this was when we used to go down to Lark Hill one morning when we got up for breakfast. There was this stone bust of probably Byron, I would say, or something resembling Byron, appeared in the middle of the mess table, which the lads had brought back as a souvenir from some part, and nobody would admit to where it had come from. But I think it was Tom Corbin Hardy, I'm pretty certain it was during his period in office, because that's the kind of thing would upset Tom, because Tom was writing very proper, and he didn't really think this was the quiet thing that his Nottinghamshire officers should do, nick a statue. So they were told, we're not going to ask who did it and where it came from, but it's got to go back. And it went back the following day, somehow or other, and disappeared back to his home. We came back one night from Bournemouth to Lark Hill, and it was during the summer period, and there were a lot of these signs, we say, strawberry teas, 2 and 6 minutes for bed and breakfast and vacancy, and I think, well, I know who did that, because I was involved personally. We had a car full of these signs, which were then all put around the camp the following morning, and they were all disposed of in the local pond. They never went back.
Who was it who did it with you?
A chap called Price, Tony Price, and myself. I think there was a chap called Peter Day and somebody. I think there were four of us in the car. It was my little Standard 8, which we took down to Bournemouth and filmed this thing, put these signs on the way back. We must have been very drunk. We went to Devizes one year for camp, and I don't know quite why we were in Devizes, but we were. and we had a race round the hut and up into the roof space and then down, and managed to demolish the floor, which was a little rotten. And we thought we'd ever build for that, but nobody ever charged a thing for it. I think simply because they were going to rebuild that camp and they didn't think it was worthwhile. But we actually got the floor well and truly broken up. What else did we do? The great man for long distance was the doctor. The doctor used to have a sports car, and he used to go miles and miles for a good meal. I mean, he'd get in his sports car and drive probably 70 odd miles with the padre and Pei and Wally Hammond, the Remy officer, and come back about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. What he'd been up to, I don't know, and didn't want to ask, but he tended to find the nightclub in Newcastle and go down there. And we got up to all sorts of things. Reesdale 1 year, and it wasn't our mess, it was somebody else's mess, and they took all the furniture out of the mess and set fire to it in a great bonfire, and they got charged for that. What else? I should probably remember other incidents, but there was usually something afoot, particularly if there was another regiment in camp with you, which you sometimes got. 2 or sometimes 3 artillery regiments, TA, in the same camp. Now, there was always a bit of fighting between the messes and carrying on, and hose pipes being set alight, or thunder flashes put through the windows when they were having their guest night and we were having our. So, oh yes, non drinking parties.
So, generally, a fairly studenty
undergrad. Well, you must remember, of course, that most of the high proportion of the of the officers in that time were ex-rugby club or were still playing. So they got set the scene a little bit. I mean, Tony Haynes, who you may or may not interview, I mean, we have a video of him somewhere. Probably a video, early video, and sitting naked up in the roof structure with singing rugby songs. And, yes, we got up for some silly things.
So that's one side of everything. Well, just to move on then, the next thing that really seems to happen is that towards the end of 60, they seem to have made the primary role civil defence. Were you aware of the changing from gunnery to civil defence? I mean, that was the year you went to the camp, but...
Yes, it didn't really last, that civil defence... period.
Okay, we've talked a bit about it, so we'll move.
We'll really get into that until the 1966 episode.
We'll come back to that then. One thing that it is, you were affiliated directly to the 1st RHA in 1961, and you were given the charge with recruiting for the 1st RHA, or at least partially. What could you talk about? You'd always been linked with the 1st RHA ever since Tobruk, but...
That's right, yes. And we got RHA in our honour title. And 1st Regiment, generally speaking, if it could, provided us with an assistant. First RHA started to recruit in Nottingham, as well as, I think, Sheffield, about that time. And we always used to house their recruiting teams and look after them. And we tried to put all our soldiers who wanted to break your army into First RHA, because there was always a leakage into the regular army. And we used to ensure, if we could, that they would go to 1st Regiment.
So it wasn't so much that you recruited directly for them, as that some of your men went. Were you sorry to lose some of your men? I mean, to the RHA, to the regulars.
You're always sorry to lose any soldier, whether he goes to Liverpool or whether he goes to the RHA. But we've always had this close affiliation, and indeed, later on when I was connected with the Army Cadet Force, we agreed that some of the cadets who were badged South Africa's became badged first RHA. There was that link, and still is that strong link between ourselves and RHA. And indeed, we are, under the reorganisation, are linked with First Regiment.
Now, in March 1961, there was Exercise Rough Rider 1, and Rough Rider 2 seems to have been a couple of years later. Do you remember that? It seems to have been a live firing exercise on Salisbury Plain, but a proper exercise. Do you remember that at all?
Yes. This, I think, was... this was not, I don't think, an annual camp. This was a weekend exercise, wasn't it? I remember it very well because it was in the... well, certainly one of them was in the depths of the winter and extremely cold indeed. And, you know, the TA in those days was not properly equipped to deal with cold and wet conditions.
How realistic an exercise was it? I mean, they seem to have just drive by truck to Salisbury Plain and then fired and then almost come back.
Because it'd be a weekend exercise. It would be a Friday night, come back Sunday. Realistic, I suppose, in the sense that you can't be a good weather soldier. You have to start getting yourself sorted out for bad weather. It was certainly a rude awakening to not drop this because it was absolutely freezing. In the morning, the tents were covered in hoarfrost. It was really very, very cold.
The annual camp in 61 was at Senny Bridge. I'm not sure where Senny Bridge is, but
in Breckenshire.
And you were sharing with the 51st Highland Division and the various stuff about bagpipes. I mean, do you remember that camp?
Oh, I do. Yes. I mean, never told you there's a Scottish regiment there that went drunk like you've ever come across. But no, we were in with the Scottish, and of course they all have their pipe bands with them in those days, and they used to get up in the morning and play their chances up against the brick wall so they can hear the pipe. And, you know, we were not used to that at all.
They appointed. You were top of the recruiting league in Northern Command, with 75% of your establishment by the end of in 61. Now, that doesn't sound. I mean, to an outsider, 75% sounds like 25% under strength.
Well, it was.
But that was the best. Was this symptomatic of the overall problem? I don't think they were that short, say, before the Second World War, or at a, you know.
Well, no, they were overstrengthened in 1939. I mean, since the war, there has been a gradual but persistent emphasis on reducing the numbers of armed forces. And I think this affected the TA as well. Nobody really said the TA is absolutely essential to the maintenance of the defence of the UK. Perhaps certain people, certain politicians would say so, but it wasn't really demonstrated by proper facilities, proper equipment, and adequate pay and allowances.
Now, what about the role of the TA committee? Because you've got some senior South Knots people on that. I think Colonel Warburton was probably on it by then. What was their... if you could comment on their role in recruitment, because you seem to have almost done your own thing, and I wondered whether they were not...
Well, the TA Association is responsible and has been responsible for the maintenance and the provision of drill halls for the efficiency of the TA units within its organisation, and has a say in the manning and choice of commanding officers, and now has an advertising budget which they use globally, if you like, within the district for advertising on television, radio, and in newspapers.
But
so
they
have a budget for advertising.
But they didn't have that budget in the early 60s, say, or late 50s.
Not as far as I'm aware.
So then their role was more just making sure Bulwell didn't fall down and
yes.
that you had decent yes. facilities. Yes. What can we talk about Bulwell? I've been there now, but what facilities did it have then, and in what sort of state of repair was it? Say, looking at, say, 1960, 61, 2.
Well, the drill hall was built as a battery strength only drill hall. And it was never really intended to have a full regiment there, or even at one time two regiments there. But of course the numbers of persons on strength in those early days was very low, so it didn't particularly matter. The drill hall had been implemented during the war by a number of single-storey buildings and garages for the storage of the guns, and was not really rebuilt to any degree until we became part of 100 Regiment and had FH-70.
And when was that?
That would be in 1990.
So well after.
Five, something like that.
So were the facilities adequate in the 60s? I mean,
not really. We were always pushed. I mean, we had an officers' mess there, which was really intended for about 12 officers. And we had 33 on the strength at one time, including the attached. We were always short of office accommodation, training accommodation, and facilities for an officer's mess.
So what about the sort of nitty-gritty of things like the roof, whether it leaked, plumbing, things like that?
Well, to be fair to the TA Association, within the bounds of their limitations of finance, they did a reasonable job, and we can't complain that they didn't do what they could.
Now, later, one thing I noticed in October 61, the regimental title was 307 RHA, South Nottingham's Isles Yeomanry Regiment, and then RA, which is dropped an H there, it seems to have gone from being to Royal Artillery, certainly for a period in 61.
Yes,
was it important?
We were never RHA after the war.
The RHA
came within the brackets, didn't it?
I'm not quite sure about it. Yes, yes, there's 307 RHA.
Yeah, but we were always RA. We were not RHA after the war.
Was this the RHA status, whether it be in brackets or not, seems to have been something that was quite important.
Well, it is important, because we've just had a big bust-up about it when the new RSM has come from 100 regiments, who said we shouldn't be RHA, and that's been squashed. We were RHA before the war. I think I'm right in saying that. We'd have to perhaps refer to the regimental history, but we were RHA before the war for a time, and we, I think, were RA during the war and subsequently, and we have never professed to be RHA, and we never wore the RHA cap badge. We always wore the South Nottingham's cap badge, and now we only wear the Royal Artillery cap badge and not the RHA cap badge. The RHA status is purely an honour title which was given to ourselves, to the Essex Yeomanry, and I think one other regiment.
Who by?
Now we have somewhere a file in the museum on the question of the RHA title. Now, I think when you interviewed Tim Richmond, ask him to produce his file on RHA, because RHA is always right of the line, and it